This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and want to welcome everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM, Channel 206. Of course, everyone tuning in worldwide on our website, on your smartphone, yeah, and even on your tablet. It's all there with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Each and every week, a portion of the proceeds from Jock Talk are given back to the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund, and I will encourage each and every one of you to do what you can to support the PDJF and to help those injured riders who have given our sport so much, and because of those catastrophic injuries they've suffered in the saddle, they're no longer able to do that, and you can help them at pdjf.org. Now, you may have noticed that I happen to introduce just myself and not my co-host here this evening, because we have received several requests over the past couple of months since we've begun hosting this Jock Talk show to sit down and have a Jock Talk show with Christina McManigal, who is usually my co-host on the program. So we're going to do that for you here tonight, and we'll give her the formal introduction, because Christina rode her first race in 2009 after graduating from Chris McCarron's jockey school. She battled through several injuries in her career and was eventually forced to retire in 2014 after winning 194 races. She's been a part of this program for quite some time now, and Christina with me now on Jock to present at Tito's. Christina McManigal, welcome to the show.
This is strange, Mike. This is strange, but thank you for having me.
I thought it'd be a little different for you, but yes. How many requests have we received through social media or through emails, and people said, hey, can you please sit down and do a Jock Talk show with Christina?
I don't know why they want to do this, but here we go.
You have a great story, and people want to hear about it.
It's interesting, I suppose.
We don't often get the chance to get into your story on the program. We'll touch on little things that have happened in your career when we interview some of the other jockeys, right. But we never get the opportunity to sit down and do this. So
here we are. Let's do it.
So what do you want to talk about?
Well, put me on the spot there.
Well, your story is so unique, and as I went back through, and you actually sent me a few sidebar notes on some things that we could talk about, which I wouldn't have known about even in researching, which I thought was pretty cool. But let's start with the fact that, first of all, people won't realize the success you were having before you were injured. You were a leading apprentice at both Tampa Bay Downs and Suffolk Downs, and were really going in the right direction when all of these injuries just kind of piled up. And I mentioned last year being forced to retire. And I know firsthand how difficult that decision was for you.
No, it was extremely difficult. Anytime I would have an injury, I remember I would recover at my parents' house here in Kentucky. I was riding out east, and I would turn on TVG. I would turn on the races, and I would literally throw things at the TV. I would get so frustrated that I was on the sidelines not being able to ride these horses that were running the horses I had ridden. Yeah. And so to make that decision to retire completely was very, very difficult.
It made your mom happy.
Oh, she's ecstatic. Yes. I feel so bad. She worried so much.
I'm sure. It seems like a lot of parents do, though. Even other jockeys that we talk to. How many jockeys do we talk to on this program? And we ask them the question, right. If your son or your daughter comes to you, says, I want to be a jockey, what do you tell them? Some say, okay, I want to encourage them and support them. Others say, no, run the other way as fast as you can.
Well, my parents were relatively in the dark about the racetrack. They didn't really know anything. And so when I went up to them and told them I wanted to be a jockey, they said, you want to do what? What? You know, where did that come from? But they unfortunately watched several of my spills live. You know, my dad was training for a work event, and he was in Georgia, and he was at a sports bar, and he's there with all his buddies, and he goes, "Hey, everyone, look, my daughter's racing on TV right now." And it was that race where I broke my neck. So they've had to witness a lot firsthand.
I can't even imagine what that has to be like for a parent.
I feel terribly bad for them. They worried constantly, and rightfully so,
yeah,
given my track record for injuries.
You said your mom, when you brought up the idea of wanting to be a jockey, your mom said, "Where did that come from?" So I'm going to ask you, where on earth did that come from? Because you didn't grow up in a horse racing family.
No, not at all. Not at all. I grew up in Southern Illinois. Everyone likes to think when you say Illinois, everyone thinks Chicago. Well, no, I was actually only about 4 hours from here. Grew up in the country, small towns, moved a lot with my dad's work. So I kind of was used to the gypsy lifestyle from the beginning, given that we moved around so much as a family.
What did your dad do?
My dad had different jobs. He worked at Hershey factory, Toyota. Now he works for Norfolk Southern Railroad. Okay. Just different jobs. And because of that, because we moved so much, I was actually homeschooled most of my life. And most people think homeschooled kids are very quiet and, you know, introverted, but that was not me at all.
No.
And no.
Not at all.
Not at all. So moved around a lot, and then I would say I was about 12, and we had just moved to small town West Salem, Illinois, and I told my parents I wanted to take riding lessons. I had never ridden a horse, really, and I was 12, and we looked into, there was a local stable, and in exchange for riding lessons, I would work in the barn. I would clean stalls, and my parents didn't have a lot of money, so that's what I did, and over that summer, my riding instructor also worked for a gentleman by the name of Judge Partee. He was probably the most interesting person I've ever known. He had one arm. He was 86 years old. I think he was a Vietnam vet turned circuit judge. And he had his own farm of homebred thoroughbreds. And it was in the outskirts of that small town there. And I would go there in the summer and muck stalls and do a lot of just the dirty work. And he came up to me one day and he said, "Would you like to ride this thoroughbred?" I guess she'd had an injury on the track, and he was bringing her back. And I said, "Well, I don't know how to do that, but sure." He said, "I'll show you how."
Sure. It's like playing poker, right? We'll teach you how to play poker. Come on over here, kid.
But I'd been riding Western Pleasure, that kind of thing, for a couple of months. I was very, very green. But he threw me up on this horse and told me how to put my irons, and, you know, I was in the two-point position, and took this horse in this big field and galloped her around there twice, and I will never forget this. It was the coolest experience I had ever experienced, and just the power you could feel beneath you, the thoroughbred, just the breathing and the hoofbeats, and I mean, it sounds cheesy, but it was so surreal. And when I had finished galloping this horse, jump off, he said, "You should be a jockey." I said, "Well, I don't exactly know what a jockey does. I had no knowledge of racing at all. But if really? That's what a jockey does, I want to do that, because that was the coolest thing I'd ever done in my life." And so after that, at the end of the summer, the judge actually gave me a horse for hard work. His name is Eagle West, was the horse's name. I still have him at my parents' house. He had never been trained. He was 9 years old. He'd only ever been in the pasture. I think that horse bucked me off every day for 3 months, and I still wanted to be a jockey. Kind of strange, I suppose. But
does it make you more determined?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When I had finished training that horse, we went to our local 4-H, and I won a blue ribbon, and it was cool. But he was my first experience of getting thrown off every day, so I knew how to tuck and roll anyway. So.
And I'm sure your parents are forever indebted to the judge for that, right?
So, absolutely.
For putting you up on a thoroughbred, yes, and getting,
yes,
you hooked.
Yes, exactly. So after that summer, I told them, I said, I wanted to be a jockey. And like I told you, they were just kind of astounded at that decision. But I was actually, my whole family, they were big into music. I played music, and my brother and sister went to school for music. So it was kind of assumed I would go to school for music. And so this was a completely, you know, a field. So so then I looked into jockey schools, because I had no idea how one would get into the profession of a jockey. So I Googled jockey school, and at the time, all I could find were jockey schools in Ireland and England and Japan and all these foreign places. And so that was frustrating to me. And I even thought, well, maybe I need to go to England. I don't know. But so I kept looking and I went through high school. And then right before I graduated high school, I Googled jockey school again. And lo and behold, Chris McCarron had just started up the jockey school on Paris Pike. And so I was just dumbfounded at that news and very, very excited. And so I applied. It was a very lengthy application process. You had to submit a video and you had to go for an interview. I went to Keeneland for an interview and it was a long process. And by the end of it all, I get accepted, thankfully. And so then I moved from Southern Illinois to Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah, for the jockey school. And by the way, visiting with Christina McManigal here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Christina, most often sitting here doing the interview with me as my co-host on the program, but because of so many of your requests, we are hearing her story on the program here tonight. And you mentioned the application process for Chris's school. Now, at that time, was it still as intensive? Were you still applying to go to an actual school with a set curriculum outside of the jockey part of it? Or was it just pretty much jockey stuff at that point?
It was both, I believe. You had to submit, you know, your high school information and all of that, because it's also affiliated with Bluegrass Community and Technical College. So you do, you get regular education. You go to college classes. So it's a well-rounded education, but you had to go through that. And so I had also actually applied at different colleges in case it didn't work out. But obviously that was at the top of my list.
Did you feel like when you were applying that you were like 99-1 to get accepted and that they're never even going to give me a look?
I thought I was definitely a long shot.
Yeah.
I went to the school with my parents to visit. And it was like, you know, you go to colleges to check the school. It was just like that. And met Chris. And at the time, there was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Mack, who kind of oversaw everything that happened. And he was very, very helpful and very cool. And he was actually positive. He liked my determination and enthusiasm. And so he really pushed for me. So I have him to thank for a big part of getting me accepted to the school.
What do you remember about the day that you were accepted?
I remember receiving the phone call. I remember where I was standing and everything, and just, I mean, it was just an amazing moment.
How about the first day you showed up there and you had a chance to meet Chris McCarron?
But I didn't know enough about racing when I first met him, so I knew he was this great jockey, but
yeah.
Okay, you know,
right.
Excuse me. But so yeah, I didn't exactly know how big he was to racing when I first met him. Obviously, I looked him up and then I was like, oh, wow, you know, this guy's the real deal. But when I first met him, I didn't even know.
What kind of teacher was Chris?
He was strict. He was strict, as he should be. You had to show up on time. If you were late, you better not be late, basically. And just the barn work, you had to work hard. It was hard work. And the riding part of things, he would challenge you every day. He would put you on the horses that he thought would best fit you and your weaknesses. And he was a great instructor. He was absolutely amazing to work with.
Did you have many, you mentioned your weaknesses. Did you have many strengths that he picked up on when you first went there? And he said, hey, you know what? You got to work on this, but you are pretty good with this.
Yes, I would say, he was always impressed with my work ethic. I wanted it so much that I would be in the barn, you know, all day. I would volunteer to help out, and he was impressed with that. My weaknesses, just because I hadn't had very much experience in the saddle, obviously I was a bit behind some of the other students in that regard. But the school was good in the fact that they accepted people who had very little riding experience. Chris actually preferred that. He said he would rather have a blank slate to work with versus having a rider who has all these bad habits from different disciplines. He would rather take someone from scratch. He himself, when he started riding, just went to the racetrack and was a hot walker and a groom, and then he worked himself, you know, up the ladder. But so he didn't have a problem with that. So, but obviously I didn't know a lot about horsemanship or riding in general, but thanks to him, I learned.
What's the most valuable lesson that Chris taught you when you were in his school?
He taught me so much. I guess just the determination. He would tell us stories about his injuries, and he would always say, it's not a matter of if, it's when. You're going to get hurt. And so obviously throughout my career, I experienced that so much. There was never any thought of retiring until this last spill, but he taught me the determination and the hard work that was required to make it, basically.
Yeah, and it worked out very well, obviously, because as you mentioned, you had to go through so many different things. We'll talk about some of those injuries and some of the things you had to overcome to get to the point where you were when you were forced into retirement last year. Christina McManigal, my special guest on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So after you graduate from the academy and you finally go out on your own, tell me about that day.
Well, the school had a program where the last 6 months you went on an internship. They would place you with a trainer in the United States. And I was so fortunate enough to be selected to go with Todd Pletcher, which was some of the best memories of my life. And so it was the last 6 months. I want to say it was January of 2009. I went to Florida to work with Todd at Palm Meadows. And remember driving to Florida with my mother. She helped me move and moved to Boynton Beach. I was 3 miles from the beach. It was, you know, from a small Midwestern girl, it was a very cool experience. And so I worked for Todd at Palm Meadows and worked there and then went to Saratoga, which was amazing.
Yeah, I would say.
Yes.
So you got right into the major leagues, yes, with this, yes, 6 month internship.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I actually stayed with Todd on for almost a year.
How cool was it to work with Todd Pletcher?
He was amazing. He's amazing. He's always so hands on. He would be in the barn running his hands over every horse's legs and watching every horse jog and would pick his riders with his horses, just as Chris would do in the school, based on how you're stronger in this area. Maybe you're a stronger rider, or maybe you're a rider with more finesse. He would pick his riders with his horses, and just so hands-on and a great, great guy.
He obviously thought you were a pretty good fit for a future Kentucky Derby winner with Super Saver, huh?
Yes, I was very fortunate. Saratoga, I was not his regular rider, but I had the opportunity to ride him on multiple occasions. Obviously, at the time, did not know what he would go on to do, but we knew at the time he was a very special horse. He was actually not my favorite, however.
Really?
He was not.
Was he your favorite after he won the Kentucky Derby?
Did he become cool. your favorite? He was pretty cool, but...
Well, how cool is that, though, just to be able to say,
yes,
I galloped a Kentucky Derby winner?
I sat on the back of this horse who won the Derby. It's really cool to think about. It yeah. really is. He is part of my favorite memories of my career. I was the regular rider of a filly by the name of Devil May Care. And she was the nicest horse I have ever sat on in my life. And she was just, her stride and the way she acted in the mornings, I was so impressed. I knew she would go on to do great things. Unfortunately, she did not have a long career. But remember, there was one particular morning I was on Devil May Care. And Angel Cordero was breezing Super Saver. And we went to the gate. We were going to breeze out of the gate. And so to be in the gate with Angel Cordero on this, he was on the future Derby winner. It's just such a cool memory. And actually, my filly, Devil May Care, galloped on out past Super Saver. I mean, she was the real deal. And after that work, Todd came up to me, and he was just really, really impressed with the way she galloped out. And, like I said, we knew she would go on to be great. Unfortunately, she didn't get to run as much as we would have liked. But that was just, what a great memory I have of that day.
Did you talk smack to Angel when you went home in the work?
No. I did not want to do that. Angel was actually very, very helpful to me in my early part of my career, because he would take me to the Equisizers in the jocks room at Saratoga. And he would put me down there and tell me to drive on that Equisizer, how to switch sticks, and just, that was surreal in and of itself, to have first been instructed by Chris McCarron and then to have Angel Cordero right here telling me how to ride this Equisizer in preparation for when I was going to go out and ride races.
How many people, jockeys, have come on this program and told us that same story about Angel Cordero. He has been an influence on so many jockeys that are riding today.
Absolutely. Angel is one of the best people in the business. He is so helpful and kind and really wants to help the younger riders who are coming up and wants to pass on his knowledge to these young group of riders. And what a great guy. What a great guy.
Were there things that Angel could show you and teach you that you didn't learn necessarily when you were in school, but they were kind of more real life type of experiences in the saddle?
They were more, I would say, it was just me and Angel. At the school, Chris had 12 students.
Yep.
So it was maybe a little bit more directed at me and my strengths and weaknesses and what I needed to do and go watch replays and this is what you should do with your, how you should hold your reins. And again, I had already been taught a lot of those things, but it was more direct to what I needed to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Christina McManigal on Jock Talk presented by Tito's. You went out and rode your very first race at Churchill Downs.
It
later
did.
That year, 2009, I believe was what, November of 2009,
November.
Was your first career start. How about that? You finally, you fly the nest, so to speak, the training wheels are off, and now you're out there in your first real race. Tell me about that experience.
So I was galloping for Todd at Churchill Downs, and I felt like I was nearing the point of when I would be ready to ride. I was working on getting my weight down. I'm obviously taller than many jockeys, so that was a struggle. I was running every day to lose weight with the sweatsuit and everything else. And so I was right near my weight. We'd actually had a jockey school race at Turfway Park in September of that year. And so that was technically my first race, but it was among other jockey school students. So that was a bit different. But so I felt like I was getting ready to ride, and I told Todd I would help freelance in the mornings, which means I just was galloping a few for him. I'd go out to the barn area at Churchill looking for a mount, looking for a horse to ride as my first race, and obviously that's
and
a little bit difficult.
You go looking around Todd's barn. You're probably going to find a pretty good one.
You know, I think Todd was a little bit...
Where's Uncle Mo, Todd? Is he around here somewhere? How about him? Would he work?
Can I ride this horse, please? No. So obviously, you know, Todd maybe didn't want to let me ride one of his million-dollar horses first time out for me. But I was galloping a horse at one of the training centers and galloped this horse every day. And the trainer, a lady, I can't think of her name off the top of my head, but she said, would you like to ride this horse in a race? We're going to pick out a race at Churchill. And I said, absolutely, absolutely, I'm ready to go. And so the entries come out, and obviously I had to go through the process of getting my apprentice license at Churchill, which wasn't too difficult. You have to break out of the gate, have steward's approval and all of that. Chris sent a letter. And so the entries come out, and I can't even... Solomon Song, I think, was the name of the horse. We were like 50 to 1. And my family goes with me to Churchill Downs. Chris went with me to Churchill Downs. And I was so incredibly nervous. I was... just shaking. And I remember putting on my silks, and there was a girl in the room who helped me learn how to put those elastic bands over your silks. And I wasn't quite sure how you did that, and showed me the girl's room. And so I get a leg up on my first mount, and we go through that tunnel, and we go onto the track. And that was just a cool memory, because I had made it. I was there. I was a long shot from the beginning, and at least I had one mount. And so I remember we warmed up and we get behind the gate, and there was a horse in the race who dumped the rider, and he was loose, and I was nervous. I was like, can we just please go now? And they're trying to catch this loose horse. And Calvin Burrell was actually in the race. I was sandwiched between Calvin Burrell and Julian Leperu, my first race ever.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. And Calvin, I think you could tell I was probably white as a ghost. I was so nervous. And he looks over, he says, just relax, sweetheart. It's okay. It's okay. So he was
during the race or
right before the race?
Before.
Right before
the
race.
In the gate.
In the gate. So he actually gave me a pair of his goggles and everything. He was very, very helpful and very cool.
It didn't help though, did it?
No, it didn't really help. No, it did not. But I remember broke from the gate, and I was last the whole way around there. But I remember how fast everything happened. It just seemed like we broke from the gate, and before you know it, it's over. And it was a mile 16th. It was two-turn race, but just how fast it seemed to go that first time out. And obviously, as I would ride more, everything slows down, and you know exactly where you are in a race and what you need to do and when you should move. But that first race, it was all a blur.
Yeah, it's the analogy that we use all the time. You hear that a lot with quarterbacks in the NFL,
yes.
Where they come from college to the NFL,
yes.
And a rookie quarterback, the speed of the game is so much faster.
Right.
The speed of the game in an actual race is so much different than what you were experiencing even in the academy or the races
right.
against the other student, right?
Absolutely. It's just a blur.
You're in the big leagues. You're playing with the pros
right.
now.
Yeah. Right.
And Calvin, Julian, pretty
yes.
cool. And you know, the neat thing I've always thought, and we're coming up on the break here in just about a minute, minute and a half, but the neat thing I always learn as I'm talking to different jockeys is that even though you have a young rider out there, the experienced riders are always looking out for the younger rider because it's to their own benefit as well, for the safety
Absolutely.
Of everybody in the race.
Absolutely. They don't want a rider out there who's reckless, who's doesn't know what they're doing. And meaning why Angel Cordero has that concern, although he's not currently riding, but he's an agent. He's worried about his riders and the other riders in the race. Obviously, everybody's been hurt. They don't want that to happen again. They don't want anyone else to be hurt in a race. So we're all looking out for each other out there.
Yeah, and what an experience. What a ride for Christina McManigal. And trust me, it only gets better. The second half of the program is coming up next. We're going to look back on so many of her memorable moments, and we will look at those injuries and everything that she had to overcome in that brief career. It's coming up next, second half of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Stay with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage. Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hey, I'm Chantel Sutherland Cruz, and want to tell you all about BetAmerica.com. It's the coolest place to bet on horse racing on over 200 racetracks from America and around the world. New players receive a 100% bonus on your first deposit, up to $300. That's the best sign-up bonus available today. It's time to play the BetAmerica way.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word JOCKEY to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Xacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word JOCKEY to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
The Breeders' Cup runs here.
Bayern, toast of New York, California Chrome. Bayern, toast of New York. Bayern has won it. Bayern got there by a head under Martin Garcia over toast of New York. It's untappable in front. Untappable the leader. Don't tell Sophia flying on the outside. Untappable gonna get there. Untappable has won it. Judy the Beauty sticks her neck out, goes for the wire. On the outside, Better Lucky's catching. Better Lucky, Judy the Beauty. Judy the Beauty, one and a head and eight, thrill it. Main sequence finishing best of all, late run from Twilight Eclipse. But it is main sequence to score. Main sequence is one and a head.
the Breeders' Cup, October 30th and 31st, exclusively here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Cal Density. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information and to listen live. If you missed the Equine Forum, you missed a lot.
Wise Dan, two-time Horse of the Year, two-time Breeders' Cup Mile victor, recently announced that he is cleared to resume training for trainer Charlie Lepresti, and he joins us now on the Equine Forum. Let's just lay out the scenario. If he makes it to the races and the Breeders' Cup Mile is here at Keeneland this year, one of his favorite courses, how many starts will he need before the Breeders' Cup for you to feel comfortable?
I mean, in a perfect world, we'd love to run him in the four-star Dave, run him at Woodbine, run him in the Shadwell, and then Breeders' Cup. But for him, if we could get him ready here all summer and not have to make a start in the summer and run him once in the Woodbine race, Shadwell and Breeders' Cup, two races before the Breeders' Cup.
The Equine Forum, giving you the inside track on thoroughbred racing. Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. on Sirius XM Channel 92 and always streaming live at horseracingradio.net.
Hi, this is CJ Johnson with your JockeyTalk360.com weekly update. Congratulations to Javier Castellano as he was able to edge out Irad Ortiz by two wins and capture the riding title at Belmont. Castellano had a solid week by winning 8 of his 25 mounts and came in the money 60% of the time. Next, let's head to Kentucky, where Chris Landeros had a great week at Ellis Park by winning 44% of his mounts and coming in the money on 69%. There was plenty of action in Texas over the weekend as Lone Star Park concluded their 2015 thoroughbred season. CJ McMahon secured his first riding title by winning 33% and coming in the money 100% of the time last week. Congratulations are in order to veteran journeyman Cliff Berry, who won our Jockey's Guild Jockey of the Week. This will be his final meet at Lone Star Park as Berry plans on retiring after the fall meet at Remington. Berry is Lone Star Park's all-time winningest jockey with 1,072 victories. Russell Bays had a great week at Sacramento as he led all North America in wins with 12 and came in the money an incredible 90% of his mounts. Finally, in sunny San Diego, Flavian Pratt has started out hot and leads the All-Star Colony at Del Mar. Pratt finished opening week winning 6 races and finishing in the money 61% of the time. For all the latest happenings on the jockey world in North America, go to JockeyTalk360.com or follow us on Twitter @JockeyTalk.
On the Horse Racing Radio Network,
CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly
Tito's
update.
Handmade Vodka.
And make the turn for home. Ken's Kate, 40 in Dilemma. Cruisin' Kelly is coming under pressure to the middle of the track as AP Elvis. And sneaking up on you, will try to sneak up that rail with one furlong to go. Sneaking up on you on the inside, AP Elvis on the outside. Christina McManigle going for three on the Colonial card. Christina says, thank you very much, Elvis. AP Elvis wins with sneaking up on you and then Freudian Dilemma.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna back in our Lexington studios and continuing my visit with my usual co-host, Christina McManigal, as she tells her story of her brief career that she enjoyed in the saddle. And again, it was a career cut short by injury last year, and we're going to talk about some of those moments. But that clip you just heard of Dave Rodman and a very special day for Christina McManigal as she won 3 races in one day. They were the only 3 mounts that she had that day. And of course, AP Elvis getting the call from Dave Rodman. And he said that you said, thank you very much. Is that true? Is that what's going through your head?
Absolutely. I was saying that as I crossed the wire. Yes. He was right.
What a day.
Yeah, it was cool.
3 mounts, 3 wins.
It was cool to go. To go out and ride every race and win every race. It was very, very cool. And that was right when I was really, really probably at the peak of my career. Especially because I won my first camel race ever at Colonial Downs.
Was that the same meet?
That was the same meet.
Okay.
It's true. And so that was, you know, I'm at the top when you ride and win a camel race. But
yeah, you were in fuego, yes, as they like
true.
To say.
It's true.
Do jockeys actually get in the zone like that?
Yeah,
you're
absolutely.
3 for 3. Can you just feel
absolutely.
It? You get on that horse.
Like, I would use that exact term all the time. You're in the zone.
What's that mean for a jockey?
It means where it's just all coming to you. Everything's flowing so perfectly. You're in the right spot at every moment. You know exactly when to move. and just everything's flowing. Everything's just clicking, and you're making the best judgment possible. And so when you're on that high and your confidence level is out the roof, and so that has to help too. Confidence is a big thing for a jockey, because when you're down and not feeling great, you know, it's harder to win. And so when you're feeling so confident and everything's going so great, you're just on top of the world. So it was a cool day.
Were you in the zone when you won the camel race too?
I was.
What was that like? I know you've told the story a couple of times here on the show, but riding a camel.
Yes.
It just sounds bizarre.
It was a little. It was Father's Day that year, and so Colonial Downs had all these big events and free hot dogs and camel races, and so, you know, they needed a jockey to ride a camel. I guess they had a sign up, which I missed, and then they couldn't get enough jockeys to ride camels. So I volunteered myself, and I remember I was in front, and then I'm nearing the wire, and not that there was probably, it was probably like a couple hundred yards that was not like a mile race on a camel, but there was a kid from the grandstand who ran out onto the track, and I can't steer this camel. This camel, I could not steer him. He was a little bit cantankerous, and so I'm terrified I'm gonna run over this child who's on the track. And so someone hurried up and grabbed the kid out of the way right when I crossed the wire in front. So that was kind of interesting.
It had a happy ending to it.
It did, yes. I won.
Is it difficult to ride a camel?
It was just different. It was very, very different. It was, like I said, hard to steer. You didn't really have any steering. And so, and they know when to stop. They just stop on their own, and then the guys
really
come out and load them up.
How
into
do they know?
I guess they've done this all
they,
summer.
They run so like many steps, and that's it? They're done?
Well, I guess that's how it works. I don't know. But,
wow.
But like I said, but in all seriousness, that was that year and that time of year was the height of my career. I would say I was riding at my best. Right before that, I was in the Battle of the Sexes Jockey Challenge at Pimlico.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which was just the coolest experience, because it was the four top female riders in the country versus the four top male riders in the country. And the fact that I was invited to participate in that was just very, very exciting.
The top four female riders in the country?
Yes, yes.
Really? So who were the other female riders that were in there? Do you remember?
We had Rosie Napravnik.
Yep.
We had Emma Jane Wilson. And
wow.
Forrest Boyce was there as well. So
wow.
Us four. And then it was Johnny Velasquez, Edgar Prado, Gary Stevens, and Javier Castellano.
Wow.
So it was very, very cool.
Yeah,
I finished fourth. I was pretty...
Four out of eight.
Happy, yes.
Split the field.
I tied
okay.
with Javier Castellano. So to tie with Javier Castellano, I was pretty happy.
Yeah.
I didn't win, but yeah, it was a win for me. But it was very cool. The bettors could also gamble on the jockeys. And so I was probably like 100 to 1, but still it was
oh,
very
yeah.
cool.
Yeah, do you kinda look around and say, you know, what have I done to deserve this? What piece doesn't fit with this puzzle? Right, no offense, but I mean
you threw out some
pretty big names there.
But
some
absolutely,
Hall of Famers.
Absolutely. I was very, very honored to be in that. It was very, very exciting. Very exciting. And so
how did it work? Did you have to win? Do you have to ride so
points,
many races, and then you get points for where you finish?
You get points for where you finish, exactly. And whoever has the most points at the end of it all wins, of course. And just, I remember we were in a turf race going, I think it was like a mile and an eighth. And I remember coming out of the first turn and looking around, and there's Gary Stevens. Here's Rosie Napravnik. And right behind me is Johnny Velasquez. And
yeah.
I wanted to pinch myself. And it was really, really cool. And in a bigger...
You don't ask him for autographs, do you?
No, I was part of the autograph session. I was signing autographs, Mike. Come on.
Well, okay. I didn't know. You know, you'll see... Take this, for example. At the Home Run Derby, right?
Yes.
You'll have people that come there, and the other players, and they might admire another...
Sure.
Another
Sorry.
Hall of Fame player that's in right. there, a future Hall of Famer, and they go up and get a picture with him or something.
Right.
Did you
right.
do any of that? No?
No.
No?
No.
They should be getting pictures with you, right?
Exactly. Thank
yeah.
you.
That's right. Come on, Rosie.
I don't know about all that, but it was also a cool spring meet, especially that weekend, because my mother was asked to come on Black Eyed Susan Day. They have a big thing for breast cancer survivors, and so that was awesome to have her there. That was the first time she watched me ride after what she went through with cancer. She, I'll never forget. I had actually had another injury, and I was in the hospital from a morning gallop. A horse reared up and flipped and landed on top of me. I didn't break any bones, but I was very, very bruised up and sore and everything else. And I call her to tell her I'm okay. And when I call her, she was crying, and she said she just found out she had cancer. And so that was really, really probably the worst experience I can remember. But so she was so fortunate, and everything went fine. She's cancer free, thank God. And she's doing really, really well. And so to have her there, and the first race she watched me ride, I won. And just to have her there, and we toured, we went to Washington, D.C. We just had a really, really good time. And so that was a really cool time of my life, I guess, was to have her there for that.
Did they do a walkover like they do at Churchill on Oaks Day, where they had the breast cancer survivors make the walk over to, say, the Winner's Circle area? Did they do anything like that in conjunction with the Susan G. Komen event?
I think they did. I don't think we could make it for that. Yeah. I know they had for the Preakness, they had everyone, you know, gather in a certain tent, and it was really cool what they do for the breast cancer survivors. It was really cool. I was glad to see that.
Yeah, great to be able to share that moment with your mom. And of course, all of that taking place, 2013,
yes.
I guess, was that yes. very special year for you when things were really rolling before you got hurt in 14. But I want to go back to your first couple of injuries. And I guess it started with a broken foot? Was that the first
yeah,
one?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that wasn't
starts innocently enough.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad, you know. But it was a kind of a funny story. I was riding at Suffolk Downs, doing really well at that time. It's
what
always
was that, like 2010-ish?
10. It was 2010. Yeah. It was September of 2010. And that's the unfortunate part of things, is that I was always just climbing the ranks, starting to just do really, really well, and an injury would happen. So that was frustrating. But I remember I was on a long shot on the turf. The horse had never been on the turf. And we were in the 10 hole out of 10. And when we break from the gate, this horse was relatively green. I think he'd only had one start prior. When we break from the gate, he ducks to the right because there were no other horses to our outside. And I noticed a sharp pain, but I'm in the race and I completely forgot about it. And so we actually photo finish. We run second. He was like 50 to 1. And I thought he ran huge. And I was so excited because this horse ran so well. And I'm galloping back to the trainer. And I jump off the horse. And when I jump off the horse, I look down and my boot is sliced open. And not to be too graphic, but it wasn't pretty. And so I go to the girls' room, and I was supposed to ride every race that day. And that was only like the third race maybe. And so I was trying to, you know, what do I do? Oh my gosh, you know, it hurt obviously, but I took my boot
off.
Right,
walk it
right.
Off,
I shouldn't have taken my boot off because, yeah. But it was split open. I couldn't use it, and my foot was so swollen. I couldn't had other pairs of boots, but I couldn't get my size boot on my foot, and my little toe was pretty much hanging off. It was really, really horrible. I don't want to go into too much detail, but
if you didn't take your boot off and see what was going on, would you have kept riding?
Oh, I tried. I put on the outrider's boot. I was ready to go. And the president of the racetrack comes to the girls' room and says, "What's going on? You're a liability to the track. You have to just stop."
Yeah, no, it's just a little scratch.
It's okay. I told him, "No, I'm fine. It'll be okay." Well, no, they made me go to the hospital, and it was broken, and I had to stitch everything all up again. And so I left and recovered in Kentucky, and then I got a phone call and went to Parks after that, because the meet at Suffolk only had about a month left, so I was already thinking about where I would go from there. And as it turned out, I went to Parks.
And that's where you suffered your second major injury.
Yes.
And this one much more severe.
Yes.
Than the broken foot.
Yes, it was definitely more severe than that. It was January 17th, 2011. And I, again, when I first went to Parks, it was slow. I was just trying to build my business. And the start of the year, I really started to pick it up. I was probably winning every single day and really doing really well. And And so, remember, I was going to win the race. I was at the eighth pole. It was a filly I had just won on prior. Her name was High Fly Amore. And that was the last thing I remember. I was thinking, I'm going to win the race. We're in front. And the next thing I know, I wake up to bright lights and a doctor's face right in my face staring at me. And apparently, as the story goes, I was lying there on the track face first, and people go out to move me. I couldn't breathe, and the paramedics were like, oh, don't move her, don't move her. And obviously, they had to move me because I couldn't breathe. And originally, they thought I broke a few ribs, and they said that, oh, well, we think she lost some teeth. Well, I just had mud in my mouth. That was it. I didn't lose any teeth. But as I take x-rays at the hospital and come to find out, when I woke up, they told me that I broke my neck. And I just start going into hysterics because not long before that, well, a couple years before that, my good friend Mike Strait, I heard about, you know, his injury, of course. And so,
and you immediately think the worst.
That's all I could think of was about what happened to Mike Strait. And I freak out and I go unconscious again. But obviously, thank God, I was okay. I broke my C6, just had the neck brace. I didn't have to have any other kind of equipment. But I was out for about 3 months, I guess it was. And it was a very painful recovery, I guess. But, you know, it couldn't wait to get back, of course.
Why?
Just because that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to ride. And this.
Yeah, but you just broke your neck. Right? I mean, this isn't, you didn't. Like, break a wrist or break your foot. Yeah. Well, you did that, but,
yes,
but you just broke your neck. Right. So why come back? Why do it?
I loved it. I loved it. That's all I wanted to do. That was the top of my list of my concern was about getting back to riding. And as we'll talk about my next injury, you'll see how determined I was to get back every time I would be hurt.
When you first get that leg up after your recovery and knowing what you just went through, does that even enter your mind? Is there a bit of a nervous moment there when you get the leg up?
No, I was so glad to be back. So glad to be back. That did not even enter my mind. And of course, when you ride, you can't think about that. You know it can happen, but you can't dwell on that fact. You can't think about, oh, I could get hurt today. You can't think that. You'll ride scared, and then you'll be more prone to accidents because you'll be too cautious. You have a healthy respect for obviously the animal and what can happen. And you come to terms with the fact that it can happen and it probably will, but you can't think about it. You can't think about it like that. You can't dwell on it.
A special Jock Talk show presented by Tito's with my usual co-host, Christina McManigal. We're hearing her story here this evening. Christina, after you come back from the broken neck, things are going well again. You're starting to kind of get back in the flow. And you start riding a filly by the name of Smarty Slewy.
Yes,
now, tell me about Smarty Slewy.
Yes. So, immediately coming back from my neck, business was slow, as it always is. When you first come back, everyone else has already taken all your mounts. And that's the most frustrating part of getting hurt for me was building your business back up again because it all fell apart when you got hurt. And so, I happened to work this horse. Her name was Smarty Slewy, and she had been running just okay. And we enter a race, and she was just the coolest horse because she's kind of funny. She would come from 20 lengths out of it, 15 lengths out of it. She was a stone closer. We go mile and a quarter mile. And you couldn't get her, you couldn't tell her what to do in the beginning of the race. She would drop back, and the trainer one time told me, try to keep her up closer. You couldn't do that. You couldn't tell her what to do, or she would spit the bit and say, well, sorry, we're not doing this today. But we got along really, really well. I would leave her alone, and then I knew all her little quirks and everything else. The way she ran, I loved that style of coming from out of the clouds and just, you know, passing everyone down the stretch, and it was... Yeah. That was my favorite way to ride. And so we fit very well together and won, I would say, five, six races maybe, did really, really well together. And she was the reason why I really started to build my business back up because as a jockey, you have to win to win. If you're not winning, nobody wants you. And so when I was riding her, she was always a long shot, and we'd always, you know, light up the tote board, and people started to notice, and they wrote about us in the DRF, and she just really, really kind of helped my career out at the time.
Is there some of that as well, where if you're winning with a long shot, people maybe take a second look because they say, hey, if she can win with that horse,
absolutely,
what's she going to do when she's on a,
absolutely,
a 8-5 shot?
Absolutely, because the 8-5 is supposed to win. The 15-1 is not supposed to win. So you obviously did something right to make this horse win.
Yeah.
So people definitely do notice, yes.
And after she was injured and ended her racing career, you actually ended up adopting her. Is that true?
Yes, yes. This was last year. It was funny because I tell people that, well, right after I broke down, she broke down. And so what's the normal thing to do? We got together and healed up together. And so she was always my favorite. I would always keep an eye on her. I left Parks, so I didn't ride her during her end of, during the end of her career. She actually went to Beulah Park, I think it was, kind of went down the ranks. And I looked her up one day when I was on the couch recovering from my hip replacement, which is what ended my career. And I look her up, and on that day that I looked her up, she, the chart read that she broke down. And so I called the trainer and said, you know, I'd love to have this horse. If you know, first of all, is she okay? And second of all, if, you know, she can be retired, just, you know, past your retirement, easy retirement, I would love to have her. And so I was fortunate enough to acquire her.
And you still have her.
And I still have her. She's, excuse me, she's at my parents' house in their backyard. My parents are kind enough to take her in. Wow. So it's very cool to have her there.
Yeah, it's a great story. Christine McManigal on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So you're back, you go through some of the highs again. We talked about those with getting into the Battle of the Sexes, and you're participating with Hall of Fame jockeys in 2013. You're winning three races a day on that one occasion that we talked about a little while ago. And then all of a sudden, here comes another bout of injuries. And this was almost one that you just couldn't get over, right?
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, it was. I was just doing so well, and Laurel Park was on a break. Maryland Racing was on a break after Colonial. And so I was shipping around a lot. I went to Delaware Park to ride this horse that I had ridden previously at Colonial Downs. And going into the first turn on the turf, she just collapsed. And when I hit the ground, my helmet strap broke. And so we go tumbling along together, and I was in a coma for 4 days. They didn't know if I would wake up, and broke my collarbone and a few vertebrae in my back. But that was another time when my mom was watching the race live. Unfortunately,
they had terrible timing.
They
didn't
really
they?
Did. They got to the point where they would not watch me ride at all because they couldn't take it. So obviously they got the first flight to come see me, and I was in a coma for 4 days. And so then I wake up and didn't really know what happened, but obviously get the full story from the doctor, who said that I was lucky to be alive, basically. And so I recover in Kentucky again. And
yet still came back to riding.
And not only that, but AP Elvis, who we heard the race call with, he was going to be running in a graded stake, I believe. And I wanted to ride him. I was going to ride him. He actually ran at Parks while I was hurt. I was so frustrated because I couldn't ride him. He was going to run shortly after Laurel Park opened, which, as it turned out, he was going to run 3 weeks after my injury. And I rode him 3 weeks after my injury. And it was too quick to come back. Obviously, I should have had a little bit more time to recover, but I was so determined that I was going to ride this horse. I came back in 3 weeks and finished out the meet there at Laurel.
I'm just shaking my head here. First of all, you lucky to be alive were the words that the doctors used. And this is following the broken neck, and this is a whole new injury. And yet you still want to come back, and you come back too early.
Yes.
Are you seeing a psychiatrist? Were you at the time? Maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
That would probably be good advice to most jockeys,
probably,
though, because
probably.
This is a common theme for most jockeys.
I blame all the concussions. I said I've hit my head too many times, you know? But no, and then I actually had maybe a month after that, I was on a two-year-old getting a leg up in the paddock. The horse dumped me and trampled on top of me. And it just nothing really was working out after that. I was hurting all the time. I was really, really not feeling at my best. And then I noticed my hip. My hip was really, really bothering me. I was having a hard time getting a leg up on a horse. And so I went to the doctors and they told me that I had the hip of a 70-year-old. And they call it hip impingement. Apparently, I was born with bad hips. They said I would have been perfectly fine if I had not chosen that profession. But given all of the spills and all of the injuries and the way it all happened, they told me that I had to have a complete hip replacement. And so I went through that. And then they told me that if I were to ever have another spill again, it would be detrimental to my leg, that it's a ceramic hip. Ceramic is stronger than bone. If I hit the ground too hard, my whole leg shatters because the hip goes down almost to my knee. So that was the point where all of the injuries just kind of added up. And I thought, maybe becoming a radio host would be a better idea.
Yeah, so the chance to have a shattered hip.
Yes.
Sent you into retirement, but the doctor's statement of lucky to be alive did nothing for you. You just ignored that advice.
Well, you know, I had no risk of further injury at that time. But then when I did, I called it quits, and I look back on my career and think that I am very fortunate to be alive and well, and so many fond memories of that time.
Do you still get the urge to get out there and ride?
Every day. Every day.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I miss it every day. Absolutely. It is hard. But I enjoy maybe some of the different things in life that I couldn't before. Like I'm here in Kentucky with you guys, with my family, which everything else had to come second to riding before.
I wanted to wring your neck the other day. You told me a story about you getting on a horse again to just gallop a horse for somebody.
Don't tell this on
the radio, please. Oh, no, I'm telling it. Yeah, because I wanted to wring your neck. And, yeah, and you were lucky that you didn't get hurt that day.
This is true. Sometimes I can't restrain myself. I just can't help it. It's like taking a fish out of water, you know?
Yeah, well, no, your story is incredible, and it is the story that we've heard from so many jockeys in so many different respects because of the perseverance that jockeys have. And I've always thought that you have to have a couple of screws loose to be a jockey, right? And I think you do. When you hear these stories,
this
but
is probably
the determination, the perseverance, and the drive to do what you love and what you want to do,
yes.
Nobody will ever take that away from you. And you should have no regrets looking back on that career.
I'm like I said, I look back and have only fond memories. I miss it.
I had about a minute and a half left. You know how we like to end this show. What do you like to do? What are you preoccupying your time with now? What other interests does Christine McManigal have?
Well, let's see. Well, I have a wonderful time here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm getting ready to go to Saratoga with you guys. That's going to be awesome. I'm really looking forward to that. And the Breeders' Cup here in Keeneland coming up and all of that that comes with it. I have to stay involved. I love the sport so much that I can't imagine doing anything else, doing something other than being a part of it. And so I help out with the jockey school from time to time. I was an adjunct instructor over the winter semester. So Chris is now retired. So that was an honor to be able to kind of, I didn't fill his shoes at all, but I helped out with school, absolutely. And that was cool to see these young riders coming up and to remember what it was like for me when I was in their same position. That was a really cool experience.
So many people asked us if we could do a program featuring Christine McManigal. You asked for it, you got it, and I hope you enjoyed this hour. I know I certainly did, and Christina, really, really enjoyable to hear your story.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I look forward to getting back in the saddle with you in the other capacity as
Absolutely.
My co-host next Tuesday evening here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's. Don't forget, support PDJF. pdjf.org. The riders that are no longer able to do their job, they need your help. And don't forget, you can go back and listen to a podcast of this show and all of our Jock Talk programs every single week right there on our website. It's all at horseracingradio.net. Been a lot of fun, and looking forward to next week with Christina back in the saddle as my co-host. For our producer, Lee Delapina, and for Christina McManigal, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's.